Good morning, and thank you for joining us here at the UN Office at Geneva for this press briefing today, the 17th of June. As I mentioned, we have a packed agenda. We'll go right into it with Pascal Sim, who will speak to the Human Rights Council, which opened its 59th session yesterday. Pascal.
Thank you. The UN Human Rights Council opened its 59th session yesterday with a global update by the UN High Commissioner for Human Rights, Volker Türk. This morning, the Council is holding an interactive dialogue on the High Commissioner's annual report. And as I speak, I can confirm that more than 115 states and 10 regional groups have registered to speak in this dialogue with the High Commissioner. And also have a few programming notes regarding two investigative bodies mandated by the Human Rights Council: the Independent International Commission of Inquiry on the Occupied Palestinian Territory, including East Jerusalem and Israel, is holding a dialogue this afternoon on its latest report, the report which was shared with you last week. And this dialogue with the Commission will be followed by the oral presentation by the Independent International Fact-Finding Mission for the Sudan. These two investigative bodies will also hold press conferences in this room, starting this afternoon with the Fact-Finding Mission for the Sudan at 2 p.m., and the Commission of Inquiry on the Occupied Palestinian Territory and Israel will speak to you tomorrow at 1 p.m. Thank you.
Thank you, Pascal. Questions for Pascal? No, I don't see that's the case, so thank you very much. Good luck for the remainder of the session. Okay, I'm very pleased to connect with Dr. Pieperkorn. Rick, nice to have you with us here, connecting with our colleagues here. Rick, I think there's a colleague that we're trying to connect with also who's in Gaza. I believe you're joining us from Jerusalem, but if we do manage to connect with Dr. Tanos Garagavanis in Gaza, that would be, yes, I see there's a thumbs up. So we'll start off with you, Rick, and then we'll go to Dr. Garagavanis in Gaza. Rick.
Thank you very much, Rolando, and good morning to all of you. Greetings from Jerusalem. So just to say, yes, I'm based on Jerusalem. Was plans to be this week in Gaza because of the situation here, the team and everything decided it's currently better to be here and postpone my trip and my mission. Dr. Tanos Garagavanis is our team lead in Gaza. It's really great that he's there. He's been there for the last for more than 4 weeks, and he will add later and also probably address some of the questions. So a couple of general points. We all know that the global attention shifts to the escalating tension between Iran and Israel, but we should continue to focus on Gaza and to a lesser extent the West Bank. Gaza continues to be decimated and largely out of sight, but not out of danger. And when I focus on the health system is at a breaking point. We only have 17 out of Gaza's 36 hospitals. They are currently partly to minimal functional. Of these, just four, including Nasser Medical Complex, are major referral facilities. So the combined bed capacity is less than 1,500 beds, and that is around 45% less, 50% less hospital beds available in Gaza than before the start of this crisis. That's for a population of 2 million people. And again, none of these hospitals are fully functional. They're partly to minimal functional. In the north of Gaza, it's even more concerning. All hospitals and primary healthcare centers are currently out of services, and the only very, very basic service provided is to one partly functional medical point, what we call in Rafah. The same, the health services are only provided through ICRC Field Hospital and two partly functional medical points. I want to focus a bit on Nasser. Nasser Medical Complex is by far the largest referral hospital in Gaza, functioning, having major specializations and major departments, and working together hand-in-hand with a number of emergency medical teams. It's the only remaining hospital in Khan Yunus, the most important hospital for the south of Gaza. It is currently within this evacuation zone, announced in 12U, and this puts Nasser at high risk of becoming non-functional. The health system cannot afford the loss of a Nasser medical complex. is the sole provider for ICU, neurosurgery, hemodialysis unit at hospitals, equipped with 26 functioning machines, currently serving more than 200 patients. It also is the only hospital in the South where there's some kind of cancer care. So the hospital must be protected. This morning, and I'm sure Thanos will say something about it later, we just received report of another mass casualty incident with hundreds of car casualties, completely overwhelming Nasser Medical Complex. Now, close to Nasser Medical Complex, we have Alamal Hospital, the PRCS hospital, continues to provide services to patients remaining in the hospital, but it is completely inaccessible. So it is what we call completely minimal functional hospital due to the ongoing military operations in the vicinity, unable to admit any new cases, hence for us non-functional. In Gaza City in the north, Al Shifa Hospital is at a 200% bed occupancy rate, putting it under immense stress. So 80% of Gaza under evacuation orders, and between 22nd of May, 12th June 2025, 9 displacement orders were issued, impacted areas all over North Gaza, Deir Bala, Khan Yunus, etc. And within that, 2 hospitals, Alamal and Al-Ahli, 7 primary healthcare centers and 26 medical points, all within these evacuation zones. And an additional 68 service point lie within 1 kilometer radius of the zones, so further jeopardizing access to the struggling near collapse healthcare across Gaza. Now, there's no, with this enormous loads in hospitals, this is immense, there's no end into injured pouring in. So we hear this morning a new mass casualty incident with hundreds of casualties. Over 200 cases arrived on 16th of June in a Red Cross Field Hospital in Almawasi, the highest number received in that facility from one single mass casualty incident. A total of 28 patients were reportedly declared dead. That's yesterday, 6th of June. On 15th of June, the same hospital received 150 patients who reported trying to access, and all actually trying to access the so-called food distribution sites. Now, I want to say something about medical supplies. They're critically low, and WHO has only some scarce supplies left, which we constantly have to prioritize. So more than 50% of all our supplies are depleted. And as the largest medicines and medical supply provider, we must be facilitated to move supplies into Gaza in a cost-effective manner via all possible routes. Otherwise, many medical services will shut down. The biggest supply, not just from WHO, but also from UNFPA, UNICEF, and other partners, is in Al-Arish in Egypt. We want this route to be opened for medical supplies. There's currently 33 WHO trucks, which would be able to go from Al-Arish into Gaza. And that's around 10 in the West Bank. Now, the West Bank, we had a lot of discussions with Israeli authorities over the last couple of weeks, and goalposts were constantly shifting, and finally we will be allowed to get some of these medical supplies from the West Bank into Gaza, and we hope by later this week and early next week that we'll be able to do that. The Ministry of Health reported the shortages in medication supply, 0 stock levels, 47% and 65% overall. We've mentioned constantly what it is, of course, everything related to trauma, IV fluids, but also simple things like masks and gauzes and gowns, drugs for diabetes, specific antibiotics, etc. Last point I want to raise is about fuel. Without fuel, there's no services. And over the last 100 days, no fuel has entered Gaza, and also attempts to retrieve stocks from evacuation zones have been denied. UNOP is trying to do the level best and taking enormous risk to get this done, and it's denied, denial above denial. Now, it's for health, let's say focus on health, combined with the critical supply shortages, this is pushing the health system close to the brink of collapse. So the WHO, the emergency teams partners force to ration the last remaining fuel reserves, already disrupting essential services. 17 hospitals, 7 field hospitals, and 14 primary healthcare centers barely running out on a minimum daily fuel, and we'll soon have none left. And let me explain what that means. Without fuel, all levels of care will cease, leading to more preventable deaths and suffering. So hospitals now, they are already being forced to reduce services. To stretch fuel, the limited amount of fuel, health workers are switching between generators and batteries to power ventilators, dialysis machines, anesthesia equipment, and incubators. If fuel runs out, ICUs, neonatal ICUs, emergency rooms, dialysis units, oxygen plant will shut down, cutting off critical care. But also vaccinations are at risk. Without electricity, cold chain systems in hospitals and WHO warehouses would fail, jeopardizing thousands of vaccine doses. The field hospitals, they are entirely reliant on generators, are struggling to function. Ambulance services, of course, already reduced, could come to a full stop and prevent timely referral, stabilization of patients. The lack of fuel will also impact water and sanitation. It is currently very much impacted water supply and sanitation. Well, water and sanitation don't have to explain how this is related to health. Weakening infection prevention, control of health facilities, and worsening disease spreads across Gaza. So as fuel runs out, WHO ability to sustain operations is at risk. No fuel means EMTs can also not be supported to run service, medicine supplies cannot be delivered to hospitals, and partners cannot be supported to run facilities. And no medical evacuation or patient transfers can take place. So fuel, top priority, not just for health, for wash, everything related to water and sanitation, and of course for food. That's it from my side. Over to you. Maybe Thanos wants to add something on the latest developments. Thanos, yeah. Over to you.
Thanks, Rick. Let me just introduce Thanos properly, just to note that Dr. Thanos Gardagavanis is WHO. He's with WHO. He's a trauma surgeon and emergency officer, and we're very pleased to connect with you, Thanos. And of course, I jumped over Christian Lindemeyer, who you know well, but he's on the call should you have questions specifically for him as well. But over to you now, Thanos, and thanks again for joining us.
Good morning, dear all, and thank you very much for this opportunity. The situation in Gaza is becoming more and more difficult. I know that we have said this numerous times, and I know that words are losing their meaning if you keep repeating and we sound like broken records. However, there's a continuously shrinking operational space for the World Health Organization and for the entire UN Gaza. What happens right now is that we are not facilitated to deliver at the best of our capacity. We know how to deliver healthcare. We know how to support health actors. We know how to act as a multiplying factor on the field so that health actors on the field are able to deliver at the best of their capacity. However, the shrinking space continuously gets smaller and smaller. Right now, as Dr. Peppercorn has highlighted, the available capacity of inpatients in the entire Gaza Strip has been decreased in a way that we have never seen before. Right now, if at this very moment we have casualties that have to be operated in a fixed operation theater, we have limited access to Nasser Medical Complex, limited access to Al Amal Hospital, that they're both located in Khan Yunis, and this is exactly where the evacuation zones have been expanded. And we have only Al-Aqsa Hospital that's closer again in the middle area. In Gaza City, we have Shifa Hospital that is continuously delivering at more than 200% of their maximum capacity. And this continuous pressure in the entire Gaza health system takes us to times where people have to be operated in field hospital. These are suboptimal conditions, uncivilized times, and this will be having an impact on the overall morbidity and mortality in ways that we cannot predict. People often ask when Gaza is going to be out of fuel. Gaza is already out of fuel. Dr. Peppercorn was really vocal that right now we're passing through a phase where hospitals, to ration their use, they're transitioning from generator, batteries, converters, and then again to generators again. So the message is that fuel is already out. Finally, we have all to be aware that the recent food distribution initiatives by non-UN actors every time result in mass casualty incidents. This very moment that we're talking, another food distribution has resulted in numerous fatalities and even more casualties, ending up in Nasser that it's in limited operational capacity because of its position in the evacuation zone. The United Nations know what has to be done in Gaza. We know how to deliver care. We know how to support partners. We know how to do our job. But to make the very best of our presence here, we have to be allowed and facilitated to. Right now, we're facing such issues at every mission of ours that it becomes increasingly frustrating and difficult for us to operate. We have repeatedly requested access to the evacuation zones for a specific number of health facilities, and it has never been granted. Whenever a mission gets forward, it is severely delayed with the excuse of operational priorities on the ground. Civilian population is a priority. This is where we should be focusing upon, making sure that patients are having the care they deserve. It's what is a priority for us. Happy to be answering any more questions if there are there. Thank you very much.
Thanks to you, Thanos. And I see Christian. I don't know if you want to compliment these powerful interventions. Please do so. I think you also dropped in the chat a tweet from Dr. Tedros last night, which is very powerful and echoes some of which we've just heard from our colleagues from WHO. But let's turn to questions. We'll start with Reuters and then Christiane. Go ahead, Emma.
Thank you. Good morning, both. Could you give us more details on the latest mass casualty event? I wasn't clear if that was today or yesterday. Run me through the numbers, please, and any detail of what those scenes were like. Thank you.
On the casualties, the one you referred to, I think. Yeah, go ahead.
Thank you very much for the question. So Thanos will have probably more specifics. What we understand, so and that hundreds of casualties, and that's what we get reported to National Medical Complex. And that National Medical Complex currently, and I got some pictures too, this look really grim. Completely overwhelmed. I mean, like their emergency wards and related to that. So they talk about hundreds of casualties. I don't know, you know, what's the scope of mortality. And as Thanos just referred to, related to this food distribution sites. Thanos, you might have more details on that, please.
Unfortunately, the breakdown of communication that happens and the lack of being able to follow up in a time-dependent way is not allowing us to be having specific information on the number of casualties. However, we have unconfirmed reports for more than 20 fatalities and more than 30 casualties. And this is, again, the result of another food distribution initiative by a non-UN actor. Over.
Just to clarify if that was today or yesterday, please.
Yeah, if you could clarify if it was today or yesterday.
My apologies, I was not clear. This is today. This is the moment we're talking. This is now.
Thank you very much. So, go ahead, Rick.
Yeah,
sorry.
And just yesterday on the 16th of June, over 200 cases, I got that, arrived at the Red Cross Field Hospital in Almawasi. And that was the highest number received by the facility in one single mass casualty incident. And a total there from that was yesterday, 16th of June, total of 28 patients were reportedly declared dead. And on 15th of June, same hospital had received over 170 patients who reported in trying to access the food distribution site. Over to you.
Thank you both. And of course, we'll update you colleagues as this situation is still very fluid, but we'll try to get some more clarity on that. Christian, German news agency.
Thank you. Dr. Tanos, you basically mentioned the question I was going to ask. We are talking about breaking point and is on the brink of collapse, and that has been the case for a long time. Can you define what the collapse would be? What would that mean? Or at what point do we reach the point of no return, I guess? Thank you.
Yeah, you know, and Tanos will come in as well on this, and more specific, because he's been intensely involved over the last 4 weeks, and maybe he also wants to say something of the ongoing activities WHO still is doing. We still do missions, making sure that our scarce replies prioritize go to hospitals. We still take emerging medical teams in and out, and we still have are continuing with this medevac. This week it was canceled, but last week it was a large medevac as well. So you might say something. I don't like to use, I've never used this word because I always got this question, oh, health service collapse. And I think and I don't want to call it achievement, but yes, it was a huge achievement in an environment as Gaza, that's because of the health work, Gaza health works, WHO and partners, somehow the health system, health services was partly to minimal functional, and it constantly shifted. And you've heard many times hospitals like Shifa becoming non-functional, becoming functional, Nasser Medical Complex, but when was it? In February 24, becoming non-functional with the siege, etc. We had to take out, WHO took out the last 120 patients, 180 patients, 80 staff, and then become functional. European Gaza Hospital now non-functional. The hospitals in Rafah were already non-functional. What I say at the moment, the number of these facilities are shrinking. And where you see where the people are, like a bit more than a million in the south, and a little less maybe a million in the north. If you look at the south, Nasser Medical Complex by far the most important hospital. It's even difficult to access for WHO. We have really, and Thomas can say something about that, difficult to access that. Now, you need this hospital with fixed OTs, operation theaters, everything as a proper, to make sure that you even can handle this med casualties incidents in a little better way. Now, that is slipping away, and these hospitals are completely overwhelmed. And then there's also a combination of the lack of specific supplies and everything related to trauma and IV and antibiotics, etc. While supplies are there, they're not getting in. And then, of course, for not just health, but very important for health, the fuel. And I think we've been quite specific on that. Now, point of no return, I want to discuss that, because there is still a number of hospitals, partly functionals, there's field hospitals, etc. And we will keep going as long as it is feasible. But the two areas which should get in, fuel first, and of course those specific medical supplies. What would be, of course, really helpful, that we will not have mass casualty incidents anymore, and that we move towards a ceasefire. Tanos, you want to be more specific, because it's a difficult question. What does it mean when it is beyond the breaking point?
Thanks, Rick. Let's hope we still have Tanos with us, because he did drop a line in the chat saying the connectivity was a bit of a... Okay. I'm seeing that we may have lost him. If he is able to reconnect, of course, we still have a couple of questions, so we can go back to him. But thank you again, Rick. Who's next? Okay, Robin, AFP.
Thank you. Rick, on those mass casualties, can you say who is causing these mass casualties of people trying to access aid? The patients that come in, what injuries specifically are they coming in with? And do you know where these incidents are taking place? Are they happening outside the distribution points, or are they happening inside the distribution points? Thank you.
Yeah, so I need to get more details on that. And I think Tanos already within Dirabala and a team, when I ask him more specifics on what's happening in Nasser, he struggles to get the full details. So I find it difficult. I don't want to answer something and then, you know, like, I'm correct. If this is outside or within or outside or somewhere around that, what we have seen happening that around those distribution points, for whatever reasons, there is a lot of turmoil and a lot of violence. And we get a lot of casualties. And I think there's been all kinds of types of trauma coming into the hospitals, but I need to get more specific. So if Thanos would be back, he might be able to address that. But I don't have the complete details on that one.
My apologies. My internet connectivity is really bad. Can I please have the question again? Over.
Yeah, it's Thanos, it's about good that you're there, about two things. You know, when is it beyond breaking point? I try to address that, so don't spend too much. But the second one is on the casualties which we see in relation to this food distribution. Where does it happen? Within the site, outside the site, and what type of injuries is being seen?
Okay, so regarding the collapse of the health system. We are walking the fine gray line between operational capacity and full disaster every day. This means that services are barely available, and this means that health workers, supplies, fuel, all these assets that are very necessary for a health system to be fully operational and be able to support the needs of the most vulnerable ones, now is underperforming. It's underperforming for a series of factors, not for just one thing. The war brings along other worsening factors. It's really difficult to be saying that the system is on the brink of collapse now before and link it to a specific time frame. But I want all of us to understand that we are walking already the fine line that separates disaster from saving lives. Right now, the shrinking humanitarian space makes every health activity way more difficult than the previous day. Now, regarding the mass casualty incidents linked to the food distribution, there's a constant correlation with the positions of the four announced food distribution spots all along the strip and the mass casualty incidents. ICRC Field Hospital in Rafah receives the major bulk of casualties and fatalities from the food distribution that takes place in Rafah. Nasser Medical Complex is receiving the major bulk of fatalities and casualties that from the food distribution that happens in Khan Yunis. And when it comes to Netzarim Corridor, the food distribution, both north and south health facilities are receiving casualties and fatalities. I'm not sure whether I have addressed the questions appropriately, but happy to be coming back with more details and figures over number of casualties and fatalities. Thank you.
Robin, go ahead.
Would you be able to say what injuries people are coming in with? What are the sort of traumas that you're seeing? And can you say who is causing these casualties? Do you know who's causing them? Thank you.
Thank you very much. As we often say, WHO is not a forensic agency, which means that we're not in a position to clearly identify from the nature of the injury who's causing them. What we can say, though, is that we're talking of gunshot wound injuries, and we're talking of very few incidents of shrapnel injuries. Over.
I mean, let me just jump in and say, I mean, of course, we've been saying since the beginning of this scheme that this is not working. It's not a safe way to deliver aid. We've been saying this repeatedly. No one should be put in a position where they're trying to get life-saving aid to be putting their lives at risk to do so. And this is what's happening. So this is something which we've said at the beginning, before the scheme began. This is what we say now, and the evidence is there. I think the world has seen what is happening. So this is something that must stop and must stop now. The fighting must stop. So thank you very much, colleagues. And of course, if you provide any more information from your points of view on the ground, we'd be very grateful to receive that from you. We still have some questions. Let's go to Jeremy Lanchon, Radio France Internationale.
A question on the casualties. It seems like there's still like the GHF distribution still leads to casualties. But I would like to know if you have seen any difference since last Friday regarding combats and bombardments in Gaza, meaning like since the start of the war between Israel and Iran, have you seen less fighting and less bombardments?
If I can take it?
Yeah, Tanas, please.
No. Unfortunately, we have not seen a change in the pattern, and we have not seen a change in the number of incidents, security incidents. So, not major change. Over.
All right, no, thank you for that. Further questions in the room? We have a couple of online before going there. Okay, let's turn online. In that case, we have John Zaracosta of France 24 in The Lancet. John.
Yes. Kalimera, Thanos. Hello, Rick. I've got a question concerning if you can bring us up to speed on what you're doing with therapeutic feeding for children, especially under five, suffering from severe acute malnutrition. And if you can bring us up to speed on the number of fatalities from a combination of factors, including diarrhea, et cetera, that is fueling a lot of this. Thank you very much.
Thanos, you might say something about if we still have those supplies. And I think, John, I think I reported a couple of weeks ago already on this. I mean, like what we of course seeing is a looming mass starvation. And I think it has been reported, IPCC report has been widely discussed, not just by WHO, but by our colleagues from WFP and other ones. I mean, you've seen all the data on that, so let's not. Very little food and everything has come in, and most of that have what we talk about myself distributed, and except what coming through the other sites, and we should not forget that when we were having the ceasefire, we talked about an average of almost 600 trucks a day, 500 to 600 trucks a day. Yes. And now we're talking about 10, 20 trucks. I mean, over the last time, it's a minimal amount. So we get all the information, and Thanos might be more specific, that people really become desperate. And I think that's, of course, what the IPCC reports were clearly described, that a looming starvation. And when I was there the last time, we went through this so-called therapeutic feeding centers in then still Operation Command 1, now not anymore operational, then still Operation 1 other place, I think the patient-friendly hospital, I'm not sure, that's still operational, and in the south. And we already raised the point that the WHO supplies for these therapeutic feeding centers, that's we're running out. And so, Thanos, you might have some specifics on this, where this is now, and what do you get for feedback? We also described then that we saw an increase in malnutrition, and of the when I was there, Kamal at one, and this patient-friendly, 200 to 300 kids per day were checked, and between 10 and 20% were then were one form of malnutrition. And yeah, I saw some severely malnourished kids as well then, which I think we widely discussed. I cannot believe that, I'm afraid that this trend has only worsened over the last month. Thanos, over to you.
Thank you very much. So right now, the World Health Organization is supporting partners to set up two stabilization centers for malnutrition. Unfortunately, We don't think that this is enough. We are running excessively low in therapeutic feeding formulas, and we're trying to rationalize its use. And our main concern is that the intensification of the conflict and the increase in the military activity is hampering patients and cases to be reaching out to us or to partners for the continuum of their care. Our main concern is that patients in need are actually not in a position to reach out to us. This is what happens right now with the shrinking humanitarian space. Now, when it comes to the mortality and morbidity related to diarrhea, unfortunately, figures are not clear. And figures are not clear because, again, the intensification of morbidity and mortality is putting all our monitoring mechanism in peril. Partners have a very hard time to report back, and we have to add to this the fact that internet was completely down for more than 48 hours on the night before the attack to Iran. This means that right now the operational challenges exceed what we're used to be working with. However, what we do know is that the water quality is getting worse and worse. We are having more and more samples where we have fecal contamination in water, and we all know that there's a direct correlation between fecal contamination of drinking water and between the increase in numbers of acute watery and non-watery diarrhea. Over.
Thanks. Maybe I'll take this opportunity just to cite one line from a quote of Philip Lazzarini of Commissioner General of UNRWA, who says the restrictions on bringing in aid from the UN, including UNRWA, continue despite an abundance of assistance ready to be moved into Gaza. So this is excerpt of his tweet last night. Okay. John, is that a quick follow-up before we go to Nick of the New York Times?
That's correct.
Okay, go ahead.
Thanos, can you elaborate if you're getting cases of cholera, what you just mentioned, if you're also tracking and getting cases of cholera? Thank you.
Thank you very much. This is negative. There's no detection of cases of cholera. And right now, we're reaching out to partners, making sure that everybody understands that for cholera, there should be somebody who brings it in Gaza. And until now, we are lucky enough not to be having it in Gaza. We are trying to stress again the importance of quarantining before reaching out to Gaza for international health workers and non-health workers that are to be coming from countries where cholera is endemic. And until now, the system is working, and nothing alarming has been detected regarding cholera. So our position is very, very clear when it comes to cholera. There's no cholera currently in Gaza. Over.
Thanks for that, Thanos. I think we'll now take the last question, unless there are any last ones in the room. Okay. Nick Cumming Bruce of the New York Times.
Thank you for taking my question. Sorry to push you on today's mass casualty events. There's some reporting that says around several hundred, 300, I think, casualties have been received at NASA, and they are attributing casualties to tank fire, specifically to tank fire. I wonder if you could confirm or elaborate on any of that. And a question for Rick, could you also just give a few details of the evacuation, the medical evacuation that you alluded to earlier, how many patients came out and what sort of ages we're talking about and what kind of illnesses and treatment they needed. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Unfortunately, we're not in a position to confirm any use of specific weapons regarding the number of casualties and fatalities that are reported today. More time is needed. Connection with the field is always challenging. And I know that we're living in a world where communication is easier done than years before. However, we have to cross-check all incoming information before saying anything. Having said that, again, I want to stress that WHO is not a forensic agency, so we're having a hard time to be very specific on the kind of ammunition that was used. However, if it is gunshot wound injuries, this is something that we can report to, and we strictly follow it. Thank you.
Thanks. Rick, did you want to add anything before we wrap up? Any last comments? No. Okay. Well, let me just take this opportunity to thank you profoundly, both of you, for joining us, and please do continue to update us.
Can I just add on this? Can I just add?
Yeah, Rick, absolutely. It's over to you, and then we'll wrap up afterwards. Go ahead.
I just want to stress again what Thanos says. So, Nick, we get similar reports, but as I said, we cannot verify that. And WHO is never attributing this. I mean, even if it's attack on healthcare, et cetera, that's not our role. We try to report, but we get similar reports. We don't know. And on Medivac, just because that was your questions, in our view, they remain extremely limited. I mean, like from the start of this crisis, we've been facilitating, supporting more than 7,400 patients, including more than 5,000 children were evacuated for medical treatment. However, since 18 March, we only have seen 6 medical evacuations, 294 patients and 458 companions. The last was last week. I think there were 34 child patients to Jordan and Italy mainly, and something like 70 companions. That was the last Wednesday. So there's still an immense need. So we still estimate over 10,000 people need medical evacuation. And we have called two things: more countries to step forward to accept patients. We need more countries to step forward. And of course, an immediate resumption of medical evacuation through all possible routes. And we really want to be constantly focus on there's a need to restore the routes for medical referrals to the West Bank and East Jerusalem. That's it from me. Over to you.
Thank you very much for that that extra comment, Rick. And thanks to you again and to Thanos Efaristopoli, to you colleagues for your interest and for your reporting. And of course, Christian, if there's anything that's lacking, please do furnish that information to our journalists here. So thank you once again, Rick and Thanos. We're going to switch now to the DRC. Merci pour votre présence ici, la participation de Monsieur François Morillon. He's the ICRC head of delegation in the DRC, who is going to speak to the situation of health, staking on the situation of health in the region of Kivu in the DRC. So over to you, Monsieur Morillon.
Comme cela vous a été signalé, le motif de ma présence aujourd'hui à Genève a pour but de vous instruire sur une évaluation, une étude qui a été menée par le CICR dans le domaine de la santé à l'est de la RDC, plus particulièrement au nord et au sud Kivu. Mais peut-être avant de vous présenter ces principale conclusion, je souhaiterais revenir un peu sur le contexte dans lequel cette évaluation étude a été menée. Donc l'est de la RDC est affecté depuis maintenant de nombreuses années par une crise double, à la fois structurelle, c'est-à-dire que cette région a connu plus de 30 ans de conflits armés qui a mené à un affaissement des principaux services de base aux populations, un affaiblissement des institutions également. Et ce qui rend bien sûr la prise en charge des populations faisant face à cette crise extrêmement compliquée, mais également de protection aiguë qui s'est manifestée par des violations du droit international humanitaire contre les populations civiles de ces régions qui se sont manifestées par des violences sexuelles en augmentation, du recrutement des mineurs également en augmentation, mais également, pour vous partager un seul chiffre, une augmentation extrêmement préoccupante du nombre de blessés civils, notamment dans le premier trimestre de l'année 2025. À titre d'exemple, le CICR est intervenu pour près de 2350 blessés de guerre et par armes dans le nord et le sud Kivu, au nord et au sud Kivu, pendant ce premier trimestre. Et ceci représente le chiffre plus ou moins identique pour toute l'année 2024. Donc en l'espace de 3 mois, nous avons connu autant de blessés que dans toute l'année 2024. Et ce trend avait déjà été constaté par rapport à 2023. 60% des victimes sont des victimes civiles. Ce chiffre a pu monter à certains moments à 90%. ce qui démontre également de la violence et de l'indiscrimination des combats ayant un effet dramatique pour ces populations. Mais aujourd'hui, ce qui nous amène, c'est davantage la crise structurelle qui représente un risque important pour l'effondrement de certains services de base et en particulier aujourd'hui celui du secteur de la raison, de la santé. Raison pour laquelle le CICR a mené une évaluation au nord et au sud Kivu dans 109 structures de santé dans les régions où le CICR est opérationnel. L'étude révèle un système de santé à bout de souffle où les structures peinent à traiter les pathologies les plus courantes, que ce soit le paludisme, les infections respiratoires, les diarrhées. On constate également que plus de 70% de ces structures de santé souffrent de ruptures de stock. 40% d'entre elles avaient été pillées à différents moments de la crise. Donc même des antidouleurs comme le paracétamol ou l'ibuprofène viennent à manquer. Mais plus grave encore, ce sont l'absence totale de kits PEP, qui sont ces traitements qui permettent de traiter les victimes de violences sexuelles, d'un traitement qui doit être administré très rapidement après l'acte, dans les 48 heures, pour qu'il soit parfaitement efficace. Et ceci s'explique en raison du manque de moyens donnés à disposition des acteurs de la réponse humanitaire. On constate toujours au premier trimestre, par rapport à la même période l'année dernière, une diminution de moitié des consultations chez les enfants entre 0 et 5 ans, ce qui est extrêmement préoccupant, comme vous pouvez l'imaginer. Mais plus grave encore, une augmentation par 4 du nombre d'enfants morts-nés, ce qui s'expliquerait, et ça devrait être encore approfondi comme étude, mais en raison de limites dans le plateau technique, de la fuite de certains personnels, en raison de l'insécurité, des manques de médicaments et également des difficultés d'accéder à certaines structures en raison de l'insécurité. Le nombre de consultations pour la santé mentale et le soutien psychosocial dans les structures soutenues par le CICR, qui inclut les violences sexuelles, celui-ci a été multiplié par 7, ce qui est encore une fois un chiffre qui doit nous interpeller et qui démontre une situation dramatique qui doit trouver des solutions rapidement. Il faut ajouter que cette situation que je vous décris là arrive dans un des pays du monde, la RDC, qui est le plus touché par les coupes de financement actuelles. Le budget de l'année 2024 était d'environ 1,4 milliard de dollars. Celui-ci devrait être ramené à 400 voire 500 millions de dollars pour l'année 2025, alors que la situation exigerait davantage de moyens. Cette situation est donc extrêmement préoccupante. À ce titre, il faut souligner que ces services de base deviennent la principale ligne de défense des populations face aux enjeux humanitaires auxquels ils font face actuellement. Les acteurs humanitaires ne sont plus en mesure aujourd'hui de pouvoir affirmer, en agissant seuls, de pouvoir répondre à ces besoins qui augmentent encore une fois jour le jour. C'est ainsi que nous encourageons bien sûr le gouvernement de la RDC ainsi que ses partenaires du développement à renforcer leur engagement dans les zones de fragilité afin de pallier au manque de moyens des acteurs de la réponse humanitaire. Je vous remercie de votre aimable attention.
Merci beaucoup, Monsieur Morion. Des questions pour Monsieur Morion ? La salle ? Non. En ligne ? Non, je ne pense pas. OK. I think you were extremely clear. So merci beaucoup encore pour votre intervention. Merci beaucoup. D'accord. Okay, we will move now to our colleague from UN Women. Sophia Kaltorp, who is going to speak to the situation in Afghanistan, and I think you have, there's a gender index for 2024 that you're going to speak to, if I'm not mistaken. So over to you, Sophia.
Thank you, Rolando. Good morning to everybody. We are going to launch our Afghanistan 2024 gender index today. But first, let me just reiterate that UN Women stands with every woman and girl whose life has been shattered by violence in Iran, in Palestine, in Ukraine, in Sudan, and even in their homes. We are deeply alarmed by the rising civilian toll. No conflict, no ideology, and no line of defense can ever justify the killing of civilians. So over to Afghanistan. It has now been 4 years since the Taliban takeover in Afghanistan. And since then, we have witnessed a deliberate and unprecedented assault on the rights, dignity, and very existence of Afghan women and girls. And yet, despite near total restrictions on their lives, Afghan women persevere. They continue to find ways to run businesses and to advocate for their rights. And the rights of all Afghans. They serve on the front lines as humanitarians, as journalists, and as community leaders. Their courage and resilience span generations. But we must also confront the devastating cost of the daily constraints that they face. So today, UN Women released the 2024 Afghanistan Gender Index, which is the most comprehensive assessment of women's empowerment and gender equality in Afghanistan since August 2021. This index assesses Afghanistan's progress against 8 Sustainable Development Goals. And the findings are extremely stark. This report reveals that Afghanistan now has the second widest gender gap in the world, with a 76% disparity between women's and men's achievements in health, education, financial inclusion, and in decision-making. On average, Afghan women are realizing only 17% of their full potential to make choices and access opportunities. That's less than 1/3 of the global average for women. Nearly 8 out of 10 young Afghan women are now excluded from education, from employment, and from training, almost 4 times the rate for young men. We also, in this index, examined women's participation in the workforce. And our analysis shows that Afghanistan has one of the largest gender gaps in labor force participation anywhere in the world. Just 24% of women are participating in the workforce, compared to 89% of men. Women's employment fell by 25% in the last 18 months, according to data from other UN agencies. And by comparison, men's employment fell by 7% in the same period. So now what we see is overlapping economic, political, and humanitarian crises, all with women's rights at the core, that have pushed many households in Afghanistan to the brink. And in response, often out of sheer necessity, more women are entering the workforce. But many have no choice but to take whatever work they find, even on the margins, just to help to put food on the table. And for those who do manage to work, it is often in lower paid, less secured, and informal roles. Women also take on an exponentially greater share of unpaid domestic work. The findings in this report are equally grim when it comes to women's participation in decision making. No women hold any positions in the de facto cabinet or in subnational governance structures, silencing their voices in decisions that directly shape their lives. And yet again, Afghan women, they continue to push forward. Some still find ways to raise the concerns with the de facto authorities, both nationally and at the local level, but often at a great personal cost. UN Women, as part of the wider UN commitment and community in Afghanistan, we stand alongside them. And we continue to engage with the de facto authorities to negotiate exemptions and find ways to safeguard, support, and empower Afghan women and women-led organizations. This report that we launched today will be a vital tool in those efforts, helping us to advocate for change and harmful practices and to uphold and advance the rights of women and girls. It notes that the issue of gender inequality in Afghanistan didn't start with the Taliban. Their institutionalized discrimination is layered on top of deep-rooted barriers that also hold women back. The international community must respond with a long-term vision, addressing the current crisis while also tackling the systemic drivers of inequality. So today, we as UN Women, we call on global partners to take 3 urgent steps. First, to commit to strengthening women-led civil society organizations in Afghanistan, including through long-term flexible funding. Second, to ensure that at least 30% of all funding for Afghanistan supports initiatives that directly advance gender equality and women's rights. And third, facilitate the meaningful participation of Afghan women and girls in discussions that impact their lives and the future of their country. The choices that we make now will reveal what we stand for as a global community. If the world tolerates the erasure of Afghan women and girls, it sends a message that the rights of women and girls everywhere are fragile and expendable. We cannot accept this dangerous precedent. Afghan women and girls, they haven't given up, and we will not give up on them. Thank you very much. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Supremely important messages there. So we'll turn for any questions. We have Robin, AFP.
Good morning. Could you say a bit more about how Afghanistan compares to other countries? Is there any country in the world which is doing worse than Afghanistan on this index? Thank you.
Yes, thank you very much. You hear me?
Yes.
So Afghanistan is as I have shown, extremely worse off. But actually, there is one country that sort of scores less, and that is Yemen, where we see even lower numbers. But of course, this is an index, and I think in both countries the situation is extremely grim for women and girls. So Yemen and Afghanistan are the two worst countries for women today, according to this index.
Thanks for that clarification. For the questions, yeah, Robin, go ahead.
What sort of engagement do you get from countries with regards to this index? Do they look at this index, governments, I mean, do they look at the index and think and you know, realize areas where they could be doing better? How much interaction is there?
Thank you very much. So we launched Index today, and it has been, it's as I said, it's the first comprehensive assessment of the situation for women and girls since 2021. So this is very much the launch of that type of engagement. We do hope that those dark figures will trigger engagement from the wider international community and to see how we, as UN Women, can work with a number of partners to support the women and girls and their rights in Afghanistan in different ways. And I think that, obviously, they are, as I also shared, work going on, and civil society organizations, women in Afghanistan, are really pushing forward, and they need all the support they can get. And we hope that with those figures, this index, that will also trigger response and action from a number of partners. Thank you.
Indeed, hopefully. And of course, colleagues, you're aware that yesterday there was a segment at the Human Rights Council which spoke to this very point. We had presentations from the rapporteur as well as from the Office of the High Commissioner, where gender equality in Afghanistan was a central message in those in-court discourses. Do we have further questions for Sophia? No online. I don't see that's the case. So thank you very much for joining us here, as always, Sophia. Okay, we'll change now. We have Catherine of the UNCTAD, the UN Trade and Development, who's going to speak to a World Investment Report 2025.
Oui, bonjour à tous. Mon briefing est en français, mes notes seront en anglais. Donc, jeudi, le 19 juin à 10h30, avec un embargo à midi et demi, heure de Genève, la CNUSED présentera donc son rapport annuel sur l'investissement dans le monde. La secrétaire générale Rebecca Greenspan et Nandli Collins, qui est la nouvelle directrice de la division de l'investissement, vous présenteront nos analyses et les recommandations qui en découlent, concernant en particulier l'investissement dans l'économie numérique. Bien sûr, ça, cette partie du rapport complète les analyses globales, régionales et nationales des flux d'investissement dans le monde. Les investissements étrangers directs ont reculé de plus de 10% globalement pour la deuxième année consécutive. Donc les nouvelles ne sont pas bonnes. Ce rapport est publié quelques jours avant l'ouverture de la conférence internationale sur le financement du développement qui se tiendra à Séville en Espagne à la fin du mois. Et nous allons également publier la semaine prochaine, je le pointe juste ici, un rapport sur la dette dans le monde qui fait bien sûr partie du package du financement pour le développement, ou plutôt ce qui l'en empêche. Donc, au cours de cette conférence, les dirigeants du monde entier se pencheront sur l'écart entre les flux de capitaux et les besoins en développement. Et cet écart ne va pas, bien sûr, en diminuant. Les conclusions du rapport de cette année vont souligner l'urgence de remodeler les systèmes d'investissement et de financement afin de soutenir une croissance inclusive et durable. Il y a un communiqué de presse global, un communiqué sur l'Asie, l'Afrique, un sur l'Afrique et un sur l'Amérique latine. Mes collègues sont en train de les finaliser et je vais vous les envoyer avant le milieu de l'après-midi. Les traductions seront en français, en espagnol et en chinois. Les différentes versions donc traduites seront ajoutées dans la salle de presse virtuelle tout au long de la journée. Je pense qu'on sera prêt d'ici jeudi, en tout cas, fin de journée, avec un peu plus d'espoir aujourd'hui. Je voudrais également vous signaler que Rebecca Greenspan, donc la secrétaire générale de la CNUSED, sera disponible après la conférence de presse si vous avez d'éventuelles demandes de commentaires sur la présentation de ce rapport. Voilà, c'est tout pour moi. Merci.
Merci à toi, Catherine. Des questions pour Catherine en ligne dans la salle? Non. Non. OK, thank you very much. Oui, exactement. Merci encore, Catherine. OK, the last speaker, is certainly last but not least, Claire of World Meteorological Organization is online and has an announcement for us about the WMO Executive Council. So over to you, Claire.
Yes, so good morning, everybody. The World Meteorological Organization Executive Council is currently meeting this week. It's for its annual session. A lot of the work is quite technical, and obviously you've all got very busy agendas with human rights and Gaza and Iran at the moment. But if anybody is interested in following up in any of the topics, please get in touch with me. We sent out a press release late yesterday afternoon. And a key part of this EC meeting is sort of fine-tuning a WMO policy on artificial intelligence. We, as you know, WMO has standards, you know, common standards for, you know, global weather forecasting models. AI is now being used in a lot of these models in a lot of weather forecasts. So we need to make sure that that, you know, this is done in a way which is equitable, which is done in a way which is sustainable. And above all, which is reliable. Yesterday we had a public private sector forum on AI, which was addressed by representatives of the WMO community, but also representatives of the private sector, Microsoft and Google, and representative of academia from Shanghai will be sending out more detailed write-up of that in due course, and then the actual technical resolutions on AI they're being debated as we speak. So I'll be issuing a number of sort of news updates and press releases on this. As I said, it is quite technical work, but it's as our Secretary General Celeste Saulo said yesterday in her opening remarks, you know, what we do is really, really vital for the global economy and for global society. So thank you.
Thank you very much, Claire. Any questions for Claire? No, I don't see it. So good luck, and thanks in advance for all the material you'll be sharing. And thanks for joining us here, Claire, as always. Okay, we're nearly done, colleagues. Just a couple of announcements, as usual, from here. On behalf of the Secretary General, just to mention that he is currently in Canada. He's in Kananaskis, in the province in Alberta, for the G7 Leaders Summit. Whilst in Canada, the SG will hold a series of bilateral meetings on the margin of the summit, and he'll be attending, of course, the different events surrounding the G7 Leaders Summit meeting, including a session on energy security, diversification, technology, and investment, and Access and Affordability in a Changing World. That's the title of this event that he's attending today. Of course, colleagues will share with you any information we receive on bilaterals. He is meeting with Prime Minister of Canada, Mark Carney. Presumably, he'll meet with others, and if we get readouts, we'll share those with you, as well as any statements, should they be made public at this important gathering on the other side of the pond. The SG issued last night an important statement, which you all have in your inbox, on concerning the anti-personal mind ban convention. And in that message, he expresses his grave concern by the recent announcements of steps taken by several member states to withdraw from the anti-personal mind ban convention, which, as you know, has ushered in many safety mechanisms. It's a indispensable tool in the international community, which sadly is, with these withdrawals, there is a need for great concern and for people to re-engage. So the SG has echoed that in the message we shared with you last night. We have the Committee on the Elimination of Discrimination Against Women, otherwise known as CEDAW, which kicked off its 91st session yesterday, colleagues, and today and tomorrow. The committee will be reviewing the report of Mexico. And then later in this week, we have Thailand being reviewed on Thursday, and then Ireland on Friday. And also to note that the Conference on Disarmament has, maybe it's over now, but was scheduled to start a public meeting this morning at 10 a.m. in the Tempest building down the road. So we can keep you updated on those activities. You heard from Pascal and the Human Rights Council. I also wanted to flag that the Security Council today will be discussing the situation in the Middle East, as we've heard from our colleagues on the situation there, in particular on Syria as well. And I wanted to announce on behalf of the Office of the Special Envoy that the Deputy Special Envoy for Syria, Ms. Najat Rochdi, will brief at 4 p.m. Geneva time, that's 10 a.m. New York time, will brief the Security Council, and her remarks will be circulated after she concludes that statement. You've already heard about the press conferences we're having here, but just to remind you, in this room at 2 p.m. today, we have the Independent International Fact-Finding Mission for the Sudan. We have the three members of this fact-finding mission who will be joining, will be sitting at this podium briefing you at 2 p.m. And then tomorrow, as mentioned, we have the Independent International Commission of Inquiry on the Occupied Palestinian Territory. We have Navi Pillay, who you know is a former High Commissioner for Human Rights, who's now a member of this commission, and Chris Sidoti, another member of this Commission of Inquiry, who will be briefing you tomorrow at 1 p.m. in this room. And then, as Catherine just mentioned, on Thursday, the 19th at 10:30 in this room, we have Rebecca Greenspan, Secretary General of UN Trade and Development, and Nan Lee Collins, who's the UNCTAD Director for Investment and Enterprise, who will be speaking to the World Investment Report, which you just heard about. And just to mention lastly, today is the World Day to Combat Desertification and Drought. There is a Secretary General's message on this observance, which, among other things, notes that humanity is degrading land at an alarming rate, costing the global economy nearly $880 billion every year, far more than the investments needed to tackle the problem. So, among other things, the Secretary General urges governments, businesses, and communities to accelerate action on our shared global commitments on sustainable land use. So that's the message of the Secretary General on this important observance. That's it from me. Any questions? No? In that case, have a good afternoon. See you here Friday. Thanks.